Previously.tv Podcast Network.
Steal
that lip gloss.
Flavor?
Bubblegum.
You mean like shoplifting?
No, I mean like pharmacy stealing. Fuck it!
I don't know.
Fuck all these fucking fucks!
What if I get caught?
That's what makes it so exciting! Like screwing a stranger at a minor league baseball game!
What? Ew.
Baby steps. First, steal that lip gloss!
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 222 for the week of October 8th, 2018. I am always welcome Ladybug, David T. Cole, and I'm here with Thirsty Motel Pillow, Sarah D. Bunting.
We'll do anything.
Tragic White Shorts, Tara Ariano.
I gotta write about this to YM.
And Loose Pube, Joe Reed.
Don't leave me out here.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Extra Hot Great. A little bit of site business up top. I'll try to make it quick. As mentioned last week, the RSS feed has moved. That is now official and looks like we're getting a loss of downloads still, so I think it was successful. But if for some reason somehow you are hearing this episode without actually having updated your feed, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. Anyways, anything seems to go wrong and you're hearing this message from the future or distant past, go to extrahotgrate.com and you can find feed information there. Starting in the very near future, most of the sort of canonical information for the episodes will reside at extrahotgrate.com. Any episode, you can just go to extrahotgrate.com/the episode number and I'll take it to the show notes for that episode.
Also, we are off next week.
We should be off this week because my head is swimming from new medications, but well, live and learn about the onset of new medications and their side effects. So I'm going to take next week off, but this week's going to be fun because I'm kind of high, I'm kind of dizzy, and I might throw up. So let's see how it goes. And that's it for site business. So our topic today with Mr. Joe Reed. Hello, Joe.
Hey, guys.
Whoa. Welcome back.
Yay!
Our topic is season two of Big Mouth. And I just want to say, before we get into the discussion proper, that I haven't had a good laugh as provided by episode one of season two of Big Mouth in a long time. This made me laugh for a good 10 minutes straight. We had to pause it.
Well, sweetheart, you don't need a doctor. You're just a late bloomer.
Mom, I'm telling you, there's this like disgusting thing inside of me.
Is it a hot poop that won't come out of the tissue?
And I can't tell you about it because you'll think I'm crazy, but Mom, something is not right.
Well, you know that you're the grateful spoon to scoop that poop out to the cruising for a tissue bruiser, baby.
So wrong.
I will just, I'll break in here and say, as we're recording this, uprocks.com, former home of our friend and past guest, Alan Sepinwall, had a ranking of all of the Big Mouth hormone monsters, of which there are now five. And Rick came in first, and that is correct. Rick is the best. Rick is a horrible, abused, wrecked, looks like a possum fished out of a sewer drain mess of a hormone monster. And every single thing he says, it makes me laugh so hard. I love the Rick voice. I love Rick. Joe, what are your thoughts on Rick? Let's start there.
I glanced at the same list that you saw. I will just say any list that doesn't have Connie as number one is bullshit, but
I... Joe, I totally agree. I love Rick, but I think Connie's the best character on the show. Never mind, just a hormone monster. But
but you are right that like the voice is hilarious and every single like non sequitur that because you don't get what Rick says until like 2 to 3 seconds after he says it because it's such like he swallows it and it's mumbled and whatever. And it's just the show was on to the next thing by the time he said it. But it's an experience. I will say that.
Yeah. So you love Connie. Let's talk about her.
I mean, you know, I'm a huge Maya Rudolph fan.
Sure.
And like that, I remember watching the first season last year and the first episode I thought was like interesting and fine. And you only see the boy's hormone monster in that one.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew's hormone monster, Maury.
Yeah.
And which is voiced by Nick Kroll. I didn't realize it wasn't Will Arnett for several episodes. Like, that's a whole other thing. But I feel like it's the second episode when you see that, like, Connie is the hormone monstress and she's there for Jesse, and you get that whole other perspective for the show that just like, oh, okay, this is what the show is up to. This is what the show is doing. It's yeah. not just these like disgusting little boys being disgusting little boys, but like everybody gets to have an experience of this. And I think that's the best part of Big Mouth. And I think Connie is like emblematic of that. Like there's that number. I want to say it's in the second episode where they go to the Korean spa.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And it's all the women sort of like celebrating their bodies. And there's the big like Maya Rudolph production number. And it's freaking awesome and amazing and unlike anything else that's happening on television.
Yeah. I feel like the first episode of season one was like trying to be as extreme as it could in terms of how gross it was in order to like make a big splash and sell the project. And then over the course of season one, I mean, starting right away, as you say, with the introduction of Connie, it gets more nuanced. And I feel like season two, even more, is consciously putting the straight white guys more in the background. Not totally, but more so than in season one, even. And foregrounding the girls' experiences more. And Matthew's he actually gets a couple of real storylines this season.
Yeah, I was very happy about that.
Sarah, this was your first introduction to the show. And as I was watching this season two premiere, I was like, if this is where she started, this is going to be mad confusing.
was it? Well, maybe give me a little credit. I am able to read the internet and look things up.
Yes.
It was, I guess, confusing, but I mean, not really. The premise is pretty clear. And also, it's hilarious. Like the little throwaway lines, like just when they're at the motel, and everything is sort of grotesque and upsetting. And she's like, there's a doll hand stuck in the drain. Like, that's exactly that kind of motel. That's one of those like a novel in six words things.
Yep.
But my husband, Dan, wandered into the office when the my pube scene was happening, which was just like, don't leave me here. And then there's like the slow motion, like mercy flick into the bowl. Yeah. My husband has one chest hair at a time. It moves around. And he was like sort of not paying attention. He like was coming in to get my recycling from the office or something. He was like, is that my chest hair? Like, is this about my chest hair? And that made it even funnier to me. It was like, your chest hair. Because it has like fallen out. And we've been like, oh no, where will it spring up next? This is too much information. I'm your host, Sarah DeMonte. I didn't watch the whole season just because of timing issues, but I will keep watching at some point when I have time. Like this show is, I don't know how it does it, but it's like very, it's just very true while also being, I mean, these things coexist, that it's true. And it's also like raunchy and sometimes it's upsetting. And the coach, what is the coach's
coach
name?
Steve.
Coach okay. Steve.
Coach Steve dwells in the middle of this very weird, like, I can't look. I have to look vet, like creepy, but also sympathetic. Ven. And the phrases he comes up with things that you're just like, oh my God, that's the worst, but also the best. Sheet sneezes. I didn't need that. I always needed that. Yeah, this is a good show. And it was like totally off my radar. And then randomly, like, I've been, my brother and I have been like traveling together the last couple of days, and he like mentioned it, and I didn't know he watched it, and I hadn't watched it before. And of course, as the founder and president of the Just Say No to Pubes Facebook page, Dave also enjoyed the first episode a great deal. It's a good show.
Yeah. The one thing that I was like sort of, I wasn't sure how to feel about it was the Planned Parenthood episode. Not that I'm against Planned Parenthood, although they do oppose Medicare. But that it seemed, it was like, seemed self-conscious about trying to make a statement in the way the rest of the show does in a less self-conscious way.
Yeah.
And they've already won an award for it. And like, you know, that's fine. And certainly more positive propaganda for, you know, any entity that serves women's health is
they won an award for that episode already?
Yeah.
For what the advances? What the hell?
The season dropped on Friday, so
the Planned Parenthood award. Like what?
I'll look it up. I'll look up what the award is. But
suspicious.
Yes, it, was, it was given out on Saturday and the season dropped on Friday. So let's assume that Planned Parenthood got it in advance.
Got screeners. Yeah.
Guys, come on. We got screeners too. Anyway, what did we think of the Planned Parenthood episode?
It felt definitely like it was out of place with the other episodes. I think you're right. There was another episode later in the season where Andrew gets put on blast in front of the whole school for being a creeper with, is it Lola?
Yeah.
Yes.
And for a second there, I was like, oh God, this is the Me Too episode. And I sort of cringed because I'm like, oh God, you're going to do the Me Too episode, like focusing on the least like likable and supportable girl. But they actually managed to like do that episode in a way that didn't feel strident or unfair, or like it just felt natural in a way that would fit with the show and still managed to like say good things and do good things. And I think the Planned Parenthood episode announces itself a little bit more. That said, for a like very vignette-y episode, I really liked a lot of the vignettes. I thought the Bachelor segment with all the different types of contraception was really funny. I think anything that I get more Missy is really good because I really enjoy her. I think seeing all of the parents' sort of backstories with that kind of stuff, it helped. It sort of was like the sugar that helped the medicine go down a little bit. And even with like the end of that episode doing this sort of fake Saturday Night Live thing where, because Nick Kroll does this a lot, I will say, on the show, where he calls attention to what the show is doing. And normally it's just in little asides where he'll like, in the first season, they made mention of just like, oh yeah, we should have the show about like puberty, but you know, it's got to be animated or that's the only way it'll happen or something like that. And I think sometimes the show could just sort of exist in itself and doesn't need that kind of stuff. But I don't know. I thought the episode itself was very funny and that helped a lot.
It was a little like their version of an after school special, you know, and how sort of strained it could get at times. That was one of my least favorite episodes of the season, but it wasn't bad. But speaking about things that kind of bug us about the show, you know, like it's always a nice hallmark of a quality show that you want to get a little nitty gritty on, you know, sort of the minor complaints as just something you can put on the negative side of the ledger sheet to talk about. I hate Jay. I hate the character.
Oh my God.
Jay.
I can't believe you're saying this.
Okay.
Sorry.
So
no, go ahead.
I just like, not that anything that Jay does, like I find generally offensive. I just find the stuff that he does as a character super not funny and, always sort of halts the momentum that an episode has whenever there's a Jay scene, whether he's got basketball boobs and tucking or whatever he's got going on. There's one episode where he's just is coming in the school and he's counting how many times he comes while he's in class. And I was like, okay, all right. And I just feel like, why is this happening? But it sounds like you enjoy Jay.
I love Jay so much. You guys. Okay. I love Jay so much. He's every little weird, perverted thing about this show turned up to like 22, but in this incredibly, I don't know, like precise way, like something about the way Mantzoukas yells. And I think this is true through all other things that he does. Like, I think he's incredibly talented and funny, but I think just the fact that they can pitch Jay so high and he's just like, that's like the scene where you mentioned where he's just like got his dick between his legs and he's just like, I'm jerking off right here in the middle of class and nobody can tell. And he's so joyful about everything. And in a way that, because we get like Andrew and Nick are so suffering and struggling with everything. Meanwhile, Jay is the other side of that coin where he's just so enthusiastic and loves every bit of this disgusting process that is happening in his life. Feels to me like such a funny counterpoint. And then that's a character that they can take to some really interesting places. The fact that they could take him into like the bisexual place by the end of the episode or the season and like have him hook up with Matthew and stuff like that was like, that's the freedom that you can have with that character. And I just think that Mantzoukas, the way he voices it, is so likable, just like baseline likable. I can't imagine what that character would have to do to like turn me away. I don't know. I just love him.
He is a good yeller. I give you that. I just find that that's of those sort of just, you know, sex shocky moments that they just do it too much. for the show. Like I find like the lot of the characters, the balance is pretty good as far as their screen time goes. I think maybe this season was a little too much Coach Steve, perhaps.
I could see that. Yeah.
And I feel the same way. I feel similar about Jay, but I do take your point that they can then use that as a springboard to take him other
callbacks
places.
To stop quoting your dad's law firm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Never stops being funny for me. I really,
Sarah, what were you going to say?
Well, there's also for me at least like a sort of callback, not callback to, but just a like a lens flare of that actor and Nick Kroll on The League. Mm-hmm. And how they interacted with each other, which I thought was one of the funniest things about that show, was Nick Kroll just responding to Jason Mantzoukas being disgusting. I made many, many photo arrays and GIFs of Nick Kroll being revolted by that guy. And just the sound of their voices brings me back to that and to, you know, that like there were parts of The League that you were just kind of fast forwarding through, but not their scenes together. And he was used quite judiciously. So I take both your points. Like, I think Dave is right that it's like his scenes can seem to go on a little bit too long.
Yeah.
The rest of the character scenes seem a little better timed and not as self-regarding. Like some of that stuff is like, we got it, cut, next thing.
Right.
But at the same time, I think he is a pretty well-balanced, like, I think that person who like actually was fine in junior high, that, you know, unicorn boy does exist. And it's sort of funny to see him in pop culture because that's not what you ever get, is that guy who's like, I have a boner constantly and it's great. Like, okay.
Well, also because I think what the show does so smartly in this season especially is contrast him with Andrew, who's supposed to be the good guy and is actually kind of a scumbag. I mean, he's figuring it out, but like the way they don't let him off the hook for,
yeah,
for, you know, being so mean to Lola and for being gross with the bathing suit in the pool house or whatever, like that they, you know, that's the contrast of like being acceptable and being, you know, passing as a normal right. kid versus just like embracing
his good intentions aren't enough. Like it doesn't end there with that character. And that's one of the like great messages. Now, I hate to say messages because like this is a show that actually does say things, but like it's not messagey in a preachy way. But like that's one of the great things that it says this season is just like,
yeah,
just being the well-intentioned straight guy is not sufficient. You also have to like work and self-examine and like take responsibility for the bad shit you do.
Well, totally. And that's why I also think it was so good the way they have the reveal of Gina, the character, and also Gina's new boobs that she just got, and all of the boys reacting to them. But then a few episodes later, we also get her telling her side of that story and what it felt like on that day to know that everyone was staring at her. Like, you know, it's so much more than just, you know, having Nick get to know her and realize that she's a person. Like, we also get her side of it, which I think is so smart and what makes the show, you know, better than it could get away with being a lot worse show. But
the interesting thing about the show, this happened in season two, and it's kind of funny just to say it, is like the world building they're doing behind the scenes. Like now, like we have hormone monsters. We now have Shame Wizard.
So good.
And we get a peek at their whole world when the depression cat. Yeah. Get into the portal and all that. And I kind of like, it reminds me of season two of 30 Rock, where they allowed their reality to loosen and to play around with, you know, the kind of the elastic reality of it all. Yeah. And Big Mouth is doing that, but at the same time, like they're building this weird mythology that I'm really into. And I really love finding out more and more about that. And at first I wasn't really sold on the Shame Wizard, but as you know, he sort of moved through the cast, I, you know, I was like, okay, I get it. You know, and I appreciate it. But then when they sort of went into the world where, you know, the bureaucracy of dealing with humans, from this other plane of existence, that was great. I really loved that a lot. How they fleshed it out.
One odd thing I want to sort of call for a referendum on maybe quickly. Nick Kroll doing the flirty banter with the Nick and Gina this season. And the fact that, like, it just sounds like Nick Kroll's regular flirty banter voice weirds me out in a way I can't quite describe, where it's like there's this child who is flirting in a way that I'm pretty sure that just like that's how Nick Kroll scores with women.
Right.
And like, I don't know. I don't know what to do with
that. A lot of the characters. I mean, I get it. I mean, I think you're not wrong on that, you know, that analysis, but all the characters have these like adult switches that sometimes pop on with their dialogue for a line or two and then pop back off.
That is true. That is true.
Jesse has
the same tendencies. He also did it last season with
Mae Whitman's character.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I felt the same way then. I just don't know.
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I like that they give that character some positive traits. I like the fact that like these characters get things that they're good at and things that they're not good at. And like Nick's not good at like being a developed boy yet, but he's good at like talking to girls, and that's a thing that Andrew is terrible at. So I like that.
I clipped one other thing that I really wanted to play. I really enjoy the moments where the girls are allowed to be angry. Mm-hmm. Not that common still, you know, of a scene to write, especially in something like this. And I love Connie's coaching throughout this tiny little scene.
So, where'd you get that?
Missy gave it to me.
I didn't know Missy wore lip gloss.
Yeah, she doesn't. That's why she gave it to me.
Nice. Now lie to her for no fucking reason whatsoever.
Oh, by the way, that new mac and cheese restaurant is finally open.
Ooh, mac and cheese. Do you want to go?
Nope.
Ha!
Yeah, the relationship between Jesse and her mother is one of the things the show gets the most right, I think. Like how mean she is and how, you know, she regrets it but she doesn't, and how Shannon just has to take it. Like the writing on their relationship is so well done, and I also love Jessica Chaffin, obviously.
Oh, I love her. Yeah.
Closing remarks for Big Mouth season 2.
I'm so glad that we gave Sarah a sitcom she didn't love. Hooray!
you've been on a good roll with that.
Yay!
Recently.
I feel like I know you by this point.
Yeah, one would hope.
It is time to go around the dial. First stop is with Tara Ariano. What do you have, Tara?
First, an update from the last segment. They didn't get an award for Big Mouth. They were honored by the Planned Parenthood Advocacy Project for that episode. But still, yes, it was on Saturday, the day after the season dropped. So I think that's fishy. Perhaps it is. just a brief mention of a show that was recommended to me on the What a Time to Be Alive podcast, which is a British sketch show, a news parody called Brass Eye that Dave and I have started watching. It's on YouTube. How would you describe it, Dave?
Oh, boy.
It's like a spoof of a news magazine show. So every episode is a different topic. Like the first one was animals. The last one we watched was science. And it looks like they get real British celebrities who I generally don't know who they are, but they like trick them into saying completely absurd stuff, like to advocate for various causes that are completely absurd, like against a Dutch club drug called cake, and they show the pill and it's like the size of an enormous wheel of cheese from a deli. They're like standing behind it explaining why. Anyway, we may have more to say about it after we watch more than 3 episodes, but Brass Eye, if you're looking for something to fill the that Michelin Web look place in your heart.
Yeah, it's kind of like
it's not that.
That
good. It's not as good, but
it's sort of in that realm. It's sort of in that realm cut with a little Look Around You.
Yeah.
You have to find it on YouTube, I think. I couldn't find it anywhere else. Maybe if you have that fancy BBC player thing, you might be able to find it there. I'm not sure where it aired in the US, but it is on YouTube for sure.
Yeah. They also go like completely hog wild with the transitions between segments, which makes me laugh every time. They're like, end of part one. And then they'll just be like zooming through this field of, you know, graphic space for like just slightly
20
too
seconds.
Long. Anyway,
yeah.
Anyway, that's not what I'm here to talk about. I do want to talk about America to Me, which is a documentary series on Stars, and it's set in Oak Park, which is a suburb of Chicago. This very famous old school called Oak Park River Forest, where it kind of got in the news a little bit in 2015 when they had a Black Lives Matter assembly that only Black students were invited to. So some white parents were like, what the fuck? and the documentary sort of makes it seem like that was what made the documentarians who it's produced by Steve James, who made Hoop Dreams, what made them interested in the school. But I have to think it took longer for it to get together. And that was just like a thing that happened to occur when they were putting together pre-production, but how would I know? I don't. So it's 10 episodes. They're all up on the Stars app, and it's just following students at this school, which is like a really extraordinary public school. It's a very mostly affluent neighborhood, but you know, there are pockets of it that are less well off and also historically progressive. And so there's a lot of students who come from biracial families and have different perspectives on race and stuff, which is like mostly the focus of where they're going, but not entirely. And it follows maybe like a dozen or 15 students, and some, they're not all in every episode, mostly Black, but there's a couple of white ones. And it's really interesting to see what a high school is like when they're just being documented and not in a kind of like A&E gimmicky way, like with Undercover High, which I didn't watch for very long after talking about it last year. And the ways that teachers can, even if their intentions are very good, can fail to connect with students in a way that they need to, particularly white teachers relating to Black students. And there's one physics teacher in particular who like says in so many words, like he's not like other white people. And he like tries to have these like bantering relationships with the students. And this one of his Black students, whose name is Jada, has to like, when he invites her to her and another student to read his like racial biography and go through it. And like, you know, it's just him telling his own story of like different racial interactions that he's had in his life. And the boy student is like, yeah, this is great. And the girl student is like, you can't act like the way you act with me. Like, I don't need to come into class and have you commenting on my hair or like picking up my coffee off the desk. Like, there's ways that you can relate to white students that it's not appropriate for you to do it with Black students. And maybe you shouldn't do it with white students either, you weirdo. It's a great show. It's like, it's the documentarians are extremely hands off. If you've seen Hoop Dreams, you know how good their work could be. And so it's on Stars. If you have the Stars app, the first eight episodes are up, even though only seven have aired so far. And so the season's almost over, but check it out. It's really engrossing and very well done.
If you have the Stars app and can actually make it work on your Apple TV.
Yes. The Stars app has been a bitch on various of our Apple TVs the last couple of days, requiring us to install it. But that's another issue. No one cares.
Libbity flu.
For my plug, I will mention that we are now done with Better Call Saul for the season. So my recap of the Better Call Saul finale is up at previously.tv. Anytime is successful when I get to work in a shoehorn in a where the elite meet to something that rhymes with that joke. all credit to Matt Groening from Life in Hell. It's one of the oldest, dumbest jokes I still make.
And what was it? Wait. What was it?
The 4th Street Travel Wire location where the elite meet to trap a German skilled at deceit. Because he is.
Oh.
Thank you for another great season, Better Call Saul. Holy shit. Such a good show.
Yeah, true.
All right, Joe, I see that Maniac is on the table. And before you start your segment, I just want to say, while you're talking about Maniac, if you can slip in what the point of Maniac was, for me personally, I would love it.
Yeah.
Okay, go.
Wait, before I talk about Maniac, though, because Tara mentioned that Mitchell and Webb look, and I just want to say that with the new movie coming out this November called The Favorite, which is an Oscar contender about the court of Queen Anne with Olivia Colman and Rachel Weisz and Emma Stone, how amazing it is that somebody might win an Oscar who played Number Wang is genuinely inspiring to me.
What a time to be alive.
What a time to be alive. We did it, kids.
Indeed.
That's Number Wang. Right. So Maniac, my sister was in town this weekend and we finished off. She had seen the whole season and wanted to see it again. I had seen a couple episodes of Maniac and I finished the season. I was pretty tepid on it through the first few episodes. I thought before we got to Emma Stone, it was a real slog just because the first episode that is very Jonah Hill focused, he is incredibly low key and interior. And I feel like you need a much more charismatic actor than he is to pull that off. I still feel that way. I still feel that way about most of the Jonah Hill stuff through the season. It would take way too long to explain what Maniac is. Like, watch a trailer. It's as to the point of it, Dave.
Yeah.
Sure. Like, I am the beholder a little bit. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's about the ways in which we connect with other people in this mad, mad world and, you know, mental health, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. I don't love this show, but the parts I liked, I really, really got into and I liked, and I was able to compartmentalize that enough in a few areas that, like, there were some moments in the season that really, really got to me. I think Emma Stone is genuinely fantastic on this series. I think she comes to, she and Julia Garner playing her sister have a couple really, really big, good, like, sibling moments in this that are really good. Sally Field shows up in, like, episode 4 playing the, like, embodiment of this computer system that has infiltrated itself into the, like, mental experiments of these characters. And she is out of control in a really, really fun way. And then she also, then Sally Field plays Justin Theroux's mother, who is essentially, like, the woman they based this computer system off of, who is her own sort of kind of, she, like, keeps getting digs in. She's this, like, famed mental health professional. She's really, really great throughout this entire series. I really like her. Billy Magnuson's on the show. Like, you can't go wrong there, right? Like, he keeps showing up in these odd little contexts, and he's always so funny. There's too much. The show gets very samey with these dream sequences in that, like, every other dream setup, and that's not dream, it's whatever, it's, I don't know, mental experiment. Every little setup they have, because it's a new scenario each time, is this, like, Bonnie and Clyde scenario in a way that felt, like, wore on me pretty quickly. Like, I don't need 12 iterations of Emma Stone and Jonah Hill in weird Bonnie and Clyde scenarios. Like, that's fine. But it was, the fact that the episodes are just a little bit shorter, that are, like, 32 to 46 yep. minutes long, makes yep. such a huge difference. I can't even tell you. It really gives you such a sense of, like, I'm polishing the season off. It is not as much of a slog as I thought. And even if I don't love every bit of it, I can pick and choose and take what I want, and I'm still going to be done within the weekend. And yep. that, I feel like, is maybe the biggest recommendation I can give to Maniac. Also, the character of Izumi, the other doctor besides Justin Theroux, yes. who that actress was in Crazy Rich Asians. Super fun, super odd. She, like, smokes all the time throughout this movie in this way that, like, this movie has this odd kind of 70s sci-fi tinge to it. And mostly I attribute that to the smoking. but it's odd. It's strange. It's not for everybody. But, like, maybe watch until Sally Field shows up and then you'll know whether to bail or not. But I don't know. I was glad I finished.
Like, yeah. you know, it, visually, it was great. Yeah. I just, for a show that centered so much around mental illness, I was expecting them to actually kind of make a statement on that, you know?
Yeah, they sure don't.
They sort of worked a way around it, I thought, and not to my satisfaction. But
yeah, no, I feel that.
As you say, it really did have a, well, I could eat one more of these episodes right now.
Yes.
Sort of, you know, exactly the pacing was good. Yeah.
Every once in a while, I'd look to see the runtime of the next one, and it's like 45 minutes. I'll do that one tomorrow. But, like, yeah. if it was like 31, okay, I'm there. Yeah.
And what do you have to plug there, Joe?
Sure. So I am every day at decider.com. You can stop over, see what I'm writing about. I've got a review coming up tomorrow for the new Paul Greengrass movie, 22 July, that I just saw that is really good. That's also a Netflix movie. Very intense, but worthwhile. And new thing I get to plug now, which is very fun. I have a podcast called This Had Oscar Buzz that Woo! I co-host. Thank you. That I co-host with my friend Chris File. We talk about old movies that were positioned for Oscars that didn't get there and why they didn't, whether they were crappy, whether they were a little bit unsung, what the circumstances were around them. We just had an episode go up today about The Fifth Estate, the terrible movie about Julian Assange starring Benedict Cumberbatch. That one was a really fun episode to talk about. We recorded one that won't go up for a few weeks about the movie Summersby with Jodie Foster and Richard Gere. That was quite a time revisiting that one.
My goodness.
The half-hearted Southern accents in that movie. So, yeah, stop over. We're on Twitter at had_Oscar_buzz. Check us out on iTunes and Stitcher and Google Play. I really feel like I think we're having a really fun time with it. We're finding we're finding our feet pretty well. And I love
doing it. We'll link it both of those in the show notes.
Thank you.
Sarah D. Bodek.
I am here today to talk about Chuck because Tara earlier today asked me to confirm that it was the Zachary Levi Chuck and not like an Egyptian true crime documentary about a guy named Chuck. Yes, it Chuck is the common. Zachary Levi Chuck. So here's how it happened. I went over to Amazon thinking I should really check out season 3 of The Man in the High Castle. It was definitely a should proposition. I was not excited about it. It was definitely feeling like an obligation. And Amazon's homepage was like, hey, there's a new Man in the High Castle. And then right below that, it was like, suggested for you, Chuck. And I was like, you know what? I'm not an animal. I don't have to high castle myself if I don't want to. I liked Chuck. I'd rather see if this pilot holds up. It totally does. It gets so much done in an hour. I thought maybe already knowing the premise that it would drag a little while I was waiting for the characters to catch up. And like, I guess it does a little, but like being reintroduced to Captain Awesome and to Casey and to their music budget that should have been gigantic, but because we hadn't heard of any of these artists yet, it was actually still pretty teeny. It's really nice to see Yvonne Strahovski not being this Gilead Vichy horror show.
Yeah.
It's a very quaint trip back to the aughts with everyone's like shaggy haircuts. I somehow forgot Matt Bomer was Bryce. Don't sleep on that. He's just so foxy. I love that guy. It's great. Fuck Nazis. I'm doing a Chuck rewatch. Who's in with me?
I love it. Yeah, it'll be fun. I'm not watching Man in the High Castle either, so I support you.
Yeah. For my plug, I do a little podcast with Mark Blankenship. Strangely enough, it's called Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs. And this week we are ranking the Footloose soundtrack. Shit got strange. So you should definitely check that out.
Mark's number one was.
Do you?
I think I do.
Yes, you do. I think you tweeted about it. So yeah, no fair, but mine might interest you.
Okay.
But I'm not giving it away. So yeah, those ranking episodes are every 10 episodes. So this is episode 120. I don't know how we did that, but we did. I'm pretty proud of us. And this episode is really fun. There's a lot of laughing and I sing in a falsetto. So fair warning. Nice. But yeah, that's Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs, wherever fine podcasts are not sold.
All right. So Dan Cassino gave me another forcing since we've been using a lot of his games lately. This time around, something from Australia. It's a show originally called Utopia, but they rebranded it because there's like 14 other shows called Utopia.
Yep. Jesus.
Floating around the world. So this is known on Netflix as Dreamland. And it is a lot like, to me, a British show I watched a couple of years ago about the Olympic bid called 2012 with mm-hmm. Lord Grantham in the lead.
Yep.
It is a story about a government organization tasked with making big ideas happen with small minds and lots of, you know, crazy things that are thrown at them. The weird thing about Dreamland versus 2012 is that somehow Dreamland coming from Australia manages to feel more British than 2012 did. The tone of Dreamland is like really subdued. All the characters in it aren't caricatures. Like it's not The Office. It really seems like these could be real people just dealing with terrible government red tape, but funny things still happen. So the pilot, which is what he wanted me to watch, has like two things happening. The office lead Tony, you know, he's a competent guy, but he can't really get any work done because of everything else that is happening at the office, everything that's keeping him from work. And then the other one is there is a urban renewal project that somebody mistakenly promised there was going to be a community garden in, but it's like a high class luxury urban renewal project. So nobody who actually lives there would want to actually grow carrot or whatever. So they're trying to deal with that. And there's like nowhere to put it. So I got a couple clips here. I think, and I don't mean this in a mean way, but I feel like this could have been made in Canada. It feels like the kind of show you can sit down with your mom and watch and enjoy, and she could enjoy it too.
By your mom, you mean my mom.
Yes, that's exactly what I mean, is your mom. first clip is, what I really liked about the pilot, though, is that the way that Tony, who is the boss, is sort of sidelined from dealing with this Chinese delegation that wants to invest, is that his media manager comes in and wants to put a new logo on the whole government department. And he could just doesn't give a shit. He just wants the work. And here is her coming into his office to explain the situation.
I can't even bring myself to look at it.
Rhonda, I just hung up on a federal minister.
Good, because we need to get on top of this. We're nation builders, for God's sake. It looks like we're still building the Snowy.
What's wrong with it?
Everything, the font, the colours. Tell me one thing that does well.
It says who we are.
Disagree. It doesn't speak to
me. It's a logo.
I deal with a lot of departments, and this is the sort of thing everyone's getting right, whereas I look at this, and what do I hear? Nothing.
What do you want it to say?
Hey, you! Get excited! Get ready! Because Australia's being built.
Okay, well, I'll take
that. So get out of the way.
Yep.
Because the future's now. Bang!
Okay, you done?
Bang.
And the other couple I have is Tony's number two, and she is working with one of the underlings in the office to try to figure out where to put this community garden now that basically some other politician in another, you know, higher up has promised it on a radio show. They got a few Twitter likes, and now they have to like maintain the lie and now figure out where it'll go.
We could put it here.
That's a roundabout.
Sorry, I just saw green. In front of the apartments?
No, that's the promenade.
What about behind?
I think that puts it in the shade.
So?
What would you grow?
Mushrooms? What about here?
That is a car park.
What if you put the car park underground and the gardens on top?
It's a little expensive.
Then put the gardens underground.
In order to grow what?
Mushrooms.
Can we forget about the mushrooms?
Please? Truffles.
So, Tara, can you appreciate, having listened to those two clips, what I mean when I say it's a show you can sit down and enjoy with your mother?
Yes. And also, I'm just looking it up now because it sounds like two of those people, now Dreamland's not coming up on IMDb, but it sounds like they might be the same actors that are on a show that I love called Rosehaven that I've talked about in this time before.
Oh, so yeah.
Tell me the actors and I can tell you. One of them's like Celia something.
By heart. Yeah, Celia Pakwola.
Yep.
And Luke McGregor.
Yeah, she's the number two that you just heard there.
I knew I recognized her voice. She's great. And
yeah.
Luke McGregor, she and Luke McGregor co-created Rosehaven. So let me see if she also is behind this.
Well, while you're doing that, I'll just wrap up. I really did enjoy it. It's pretty dry and low key, but it still really works. And the fact that a lot of it revolved around graphic design and community thinking, and by community thinking, I mean the bad kind in an office where everything's done by committee, that really appealed to me. I thought it was really great. And the logo they come up with is so stupid and is such a, everywhere else outside the US, there are sort of media trends. Like a couple years ago, every network outside of the US was using like flowing scarves in their station identification stuff, and now it's all like overlapping colors and stuff like that. Like the international trends, they just sort of like, it's all mush, you know, once you get outside the US, and this reflects that so well. I was really pleased with how they got that part right. Anyways, Tara.
Yes, Luke McGregor is also in, from Rosehaven, is also in Dreamland, although neither of them wrote on that, which they did on Rosehaven as well. But now I'm interested in the show, which I didn't know existed. So thanks, Dan Cassino.
Thanks, Dan Cassino. Three seasons, and I think they're filming a fourth right now. It's about to air. So check it out. Google either Utopia Australia or Dreamland, and you will find it. Up Uh-oh, that backwards music means it is time for the evil goateed twin of the canon. It is the No Knack, a particularly bad episode of a usually good series. That's the metric. Joe Reed is presenting. What do you got, Joe?
So as I look here at my presentation, I realize that I did not find a spot to elegantly fit in the title of the episode. So I'm just going to say it out front, bluntly and awkwardly. I am presenting Friends Season 7, Episode 13, titled The One Where Rosita Dies. I will do my best to explain why it's bad. First off, though, I really, really like Friends. I don't like Friends like Tara level, but like who could? I really, really do love this show. And for me, it hit its peak in seasons 4 and 5. I think the first 3 seasons are also fantastic. By the time it had gotten around to season 10, it was, to me, really limping to its finish. I thought the seasons sort of 7 through 10 to me are very hit and miss. But some of that was sort of the usual long-running show attrition. But a lot of that was pressure that NBC put on the show once Seinfeld was gone. And after 9/11 especially, to sort of be this shining beacon for the network. Obviously, the ratings were really good. But they put, I feel like they put a lot of pressure on Friends to sort of bail them out of a lot of stuff.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but when you said a lot of pressure after 9/11, they could say to task the cast of Friends to capture Osama bin Laden.
Oh God. America needed to be brought back together, Dave.
And I don't know about the actors, but Monica Geller could definitely find and kill Osama bin Laden. And we all know.
Oh, sorry, Joe. Oh, my God.
No, that's an important distinction. Not that is what I'm talking about. Other things. They sort of look to Friends to be that uncomplicated, familiar, good time that viewers were looking for at that period of time. But even before that, there was the dawn of reality TV and especially CBS's Survivor. CBS debuted Survivor in the summer of 2000 on Wednesday nights, but before the fall started, they announced a move to Thursdays for its much hyped second season to debut after the Super Bowl in February, directly taking on NBC's dominant but now maybe vulnerable must-see TV lineup. So in order to combat this new competition, NBC would eventually push for supersized episodes, and before that, they really stepped up to stunt guest casting on the show. This was a thing that NBC was not stranger to, look to shows like Will and Grace. But on Friends, every week there seemed to be, at some point it got to be like every week there was one, maybe even sometimes two, big name guest stars: Susan Sarandon, Brad Pitt, Sean Penn, these big sort of movie star names. Very few of them held up to expectations.
Joe, to prove your point,
yes,
that whole spiel you just did sounded eerily like Troy McClure in that 125th Simpsons episode, you know, guest star after guest star.
Yeah, with similar results for sure. Survivor Australia premiered, like I said, Super Bowl Sunday, January 28th, 2001. This Friends episode, the one where Rosita dies, aired the following Thursday, which was the first night that both Friends and Survivor went head to head. NBC decided to rally the old must-see TV troops by casting Seinfeld star Jason Alexander in a guest role. I'm going to say it did not turn out well. So I'm going to sort of split this up into the three plots. In the least offensive storyline of the show, the one the episode is named after, Rachel gets mad that there's no place for her to sit in her and Joey's apartment. She and Joey start sparring over Joey's Barca lounger, which we find out is named Rosita. And Rachel, as she sort of struggles to move it, she breaks it. Thus begins a series of misadventures where Rachel tries to fix the chair poorly. Chandler comes over, sits in the chair, thinks he broke it. Then he replaces it with his Barca lounger. And then Rachel buys a fancy schmancy new Lazy Boy to compensate, making Joey jealous of the new fancy chair in the process. It's fine, but it all feels slightly warmed over. Although I will clip the worst part of this storyline, which is this poorly disguised native advertisement for Lazy Boy.
How would you like to sit in a chair that fully reclines, has a rolling massage, and speakers in the headrest?
Yeah, I'd love to, but I've tried that so many times, they won't even let me in the store anymore.
Well, what if I told you that you could do it in my apartment?
Are you telling me You bought the chair that is making all other lounge systems obsolete, the chair that Sit Magazine called Chair of the Year?
I just purchased the Lazy Boy Ecliner 3000.
The Lazy Boy 3000 is a real chair. I am disgusted.
I was just looking up to see if it was real.
I did too. I mean, I'll get into it when it's my turn.
So yes, in the second least offensive storyline, or second most offensive storyline, if you're pessimistic, Ross and Monica find out their parents are selling their childhood home. So they head back to clear out their old stuff out of the garage. Only when they get there, they find out from Jack, who is the only Geller parent in this episode, Judy is not around, that while Ross's boxes of mementos are high and dry, Monica's were waterlogged and destroyed the last time the garage flooded because Jack wanted to keep his Porsche dry. Which, even for bumbling old Jack Geller, this feels like a very callous turn of character. The boxes getting flooded to me is one thing, but Jack actively sacrificing them for his fancy car, it feels cruel, and it throws off the whole balance of the story for me, which is still just another spin on Monica feeling like her parents love Ross more, which we've seen a bunch of times. It's a flavor on Monica that has worked in the past, but like many things Friends did with Monica in the later seasons, it comes out shrill and whiny. Oh, and also, it can't be a bad Monica storyline without a joke at the expense of her fat past in clip number two.
Well, I don't know what's in the boxes down here, but I do know that there are 6 or 7 Easy Bake ovens in the attic.
I used to love to play restaurant.
Not as much as you love to play uncooked batter eater.
Okay. It is unreasonable to expect a child to wait for a light bulb to cook brownies.
Listen, Big Fat Goalie is a mean joke too, but it was one time and it was in the middle of one of the greatest Friends scenes of all time. That is not the case for this episode, decidedly. So, finally we end up at the worst storyline and the reason that I'm submitting this episode for the no-nack. Phoebe needs to make more money, so she takes a job at a call center selling toner on the phone. One of her first customers is played by aforementioned Jason Alexander, and he tells her that he doesn't need any toner because he intends to kill himself in clip number 3.
Hi, Earl. This is Phoebe from Empire Office Supplies. I'd like to talk to you about your toner needs.
I don't need any toner.
I'm hearing what you're saying, but at our prices, everyone needs toner.
Not me.
May I ask why?
You want to know why? You want to know why?
I surely do.
Okay. I don't need any toner because I'm going to kill myself.
Is that because you're out of toner?
I'm not saying that suicide isn't funny. I'm saying this guy's suicide is boring as fuck. What follows is a series of go nowhere jokes where Phoebe tries to give Jason Alexander reasons to live. And he's basically like, no. And with the exception of one joke where he talks about his awful job and coworkers who hate him, and Phoebe is like, Chandler, which I thought was kind of fine. None of it is funny. So observe clip number 4.
I'm sure that people know you exist.
Oh, yeah? I work in a cubicle surrounded by people. I've been talking to you for 5 minutes now about killing myself, and no one's even looked up from their desk. Hang on. Hey, everybody. I'm going to kill myself. I got nothing.
Very not funny. I pretty much clipped just every single attempt at a joke in the storyline. Here is one more. Observe.
All right, so Earl, let's just forget about the people at the office, okay? There's got to be someone else in your life that's worth sticking around for. What about your family or friends or maybe a girlfriend?
Yeah, right.
Oh, sorry, boyfriend.
And one more, clip number 6.
Do you know what happened to Chandler's Barker Lounger?
Oh, yeah, Joey broke it. Had to get rid of it.
Are you kidding? I'd get a Porsche and the Barca Lounger's gone? This is the best day ever!
All right, I got ahead of myself. That's the post-credit sting, which brings Monica back into the Rosita storyline and doesn't even give it the respect to do anything clever but a best day ever joke, which is so lazy. It's so disheartening. The problem with trying to put a Friends episode for the No Knack is that the cast has the talent and the comedic timing to keep from ever fully bottoming out. But this episode, rather than being the exact scientific rock bottom of the later seasons, is more to me emblematic of what made the last several seasons of the show so subpar. For me, it wasn't the constant shuffling of Ross and Rachel and Joey's love lives. It wasn't baby crazy Monica. It was the overall desperation to hold on to ratings and relevance with guest stars who didn't mesh and stories that felt very warmed over. Even this post-credits tag, it just dies on the vine. It is so... A bad Friends episode is such a bummer to me. I can't even fully describe why. Because it's such a show that, like, to me, it's just so... At its best, the show is such an easy way to, like, sit down for half an hour and enjoy myself. And it just doesn't. Whether this episode is emblematic, if maybe not fully execrable episode of Friends, whether this episode meets the canon criteria specifically or not, I'll leave up to you. I just know that when this one comes up in the Netflix rotation, I skip it. When it comes on cable, I switch to cable news. Cable news.
Holy shit.
Wow. Friends, you broke Joe's gentle heart.
Wow. Shall I go first and Tara should go last? Since
yeah,
she's
I should
the
go last.
Friends sure. professor.
Yeah.
Okay, so I did not read the doc closely and thought this was a canon submission.
Oh, no.
And was like, was Joe hit in the head with like a 7-iron repeatedly? Because I don't, like, I'm not a huge Friends super fan and have seen, like, maybe, like, the episodes that we've considered for canon or No Knack, and then maybe 5 more than that.
Right.
But I almost always enjoy it, and it's like, oh, I see. And I kept getting little glimmers of like, well, okay, maybe I see where he's going with this. Huh. And then I looked at the clips that he pulled and I was like, what? And then my eyes sort of floated up and I was like, oh my God. But those clips were extremely well advised because yeah. you really get on the podcast only listening in a way that you may not when you're watching it because of the like all the familiar signifiers about it, that the transitional music cues are horrifying. Yeah. Like they're just so, it's so bad. It's so bleak. It's like Natural Born Killers level. It's awful. But for a while I was fooled because as Joe mentioned, the cast are pros and their game. This is like peak Rachel hair post shag.
Yep.
Aniston looks great. LeBlanc's delivery as usual, like I, you know, he's always sort of my stealth. Like, I think he's really the secret weapon of the show.
He's the special sauce. Yeah, for sure.
He really is. she's not even cold yet. Delivery was just like so heartfelt. And then the little background labels in the garage, like that, just everything that they kept of Ross's, like Ross's magazines,
yeah.
Ross's bone collection. And I was like, okay. But then in the background of Earl's office on his whiteboard, it's like today's tasks, kill self. Like, guys.
Yeah.
I mean,
take one thing off before you leave.
Guys. Yeah. That's just, and then the lazy boy thing, I don't know, like that didn't bother me that much, but this really did feel strained. Like it was at the point where I think the show might have had a little trouble kind of incorporating the like uptight
yeah.
things about Monica that I think the show and the writers loved into the changes in her life that were going more towards settling down and having a family. And they had real trouble like keeping that lovable and not making her a queen of the hoppies. And it didn't always work out for yeah. them or her. And this was definitely one of those. And just that sort of, I don't know, Like, she was a kid who liked to eat. We got it. It's season seven. Stop. But yeah, I was relieved to find this was a no knack. However, like, it wasn't that one storyline was disastrous. And I think that might be enough. And you know how I love that no knack music, but I also feel like perhaps I am not, as steeped in the Friends-averse as some on this panel. So Dave Cole, take it away. And then we will hear from Dr. Ariano.
All right. So I think one of the big problems with the suicide storyline beyond existing is Jason Alexander being the guy that you are interacting with. And I'm not even sure whether you're supposed to be laughing at him, feeling sorry for him. Jason Alexander cannot evoke any of that for me.
Yeah.
Especially with that hair, which I'm not sure is his, or whether they just threw pubes on glue. Like, it is so weird.
Yeah.
I think, to put in perspective, if you haven't watched this episode in a while, take out Jason Alexander, and I just had this thought, so I can't remember the actor's name, but that sad Basset Hound actor, Vincent Scaravelli or whatever
Schiavelli,
his name
is.
Schiavelli,
yeah.
Put that guy in there. Now that storyline becomes certainly tragic and super sad, and I think that really sort of like explains why this is super not funny. Jason Alexander can't pull it off because it's unpull-offable. So, you know, just lean into it and get a really sad puppy, you know, to run that suicide storyline. Speaking about sad puppies, you know why Joey works and he's the secret sauce? Because he's like a wet puppy in the rain you want to pick up and take home in all his scenes. Like, he's just so dumb and lovable all the time.
He is.
That you just can't help but, like, oh, come on. His chair's broken, but it's not broken now, but he still wants the other one. Just let him have the nice chair.
Let's get him a present.
Yeah, exactly. Let's buy him a present. Remember when baby blue and maroon were such a hot color combo? On Rachel's asymmetric shirt she was wearing.
It's my high school colors. She looked like my yearbook.
See, also medium brown and pink, if we're talking 90s color combos.
Oh, sure.
Sure.
Yeah. But yeah, this, the chair one, it was fine. Like, that was okay, Friends material. Perfectly fine, acceptable. Nothing bad about it. It was, you know, a nice little Joey storyline.
Dave, was it enough to make you change the channel from Jerry rifling through Cal's backpack and finding beef jerky and framing him for a tribal council vote? I don't think so.
That's true. You did still watch Survivor at this point, Dave.
Yeah. Was that season? So it was a season one or season two?
Season two.
Was that the
episode.
Mitchell season?
It was the episode before the Mitchell episode.
Oh, the Mitchell episode. That's my favorite, like, reality show moment ever. Mitchell betrayal on the way to tribal council.
Should submit it for the canon sometime.
I think we talked about it at some point, didn't we?
Maybe.
I know we talked about it with Joe.
I know, anyway. John submitted an episode from that season that was not that episode. But
That's right. Yeah. Anyways, back to Friends. The playing gay for laughs part, Clunkaroony. The episode isn't like an unmitigated, you know, Zeppelin on the tower disaster. Oh, the humanity. You know, like some of these can be, like, good. Your Black Markets for me is always my, you know, the one that's like, what the fuck? Why are you doing Battlestar Galactica? But this is from a different, like, show, and you just bought a script and you made it and you put Apollo in it and it's terrible. You know, this is identifiably Friends, but, like, it's like one of the writers had the flu and had to give the script to her uncle who didn't really get it. It is kind of creepy and, you know, doesn't, you know, it just, like, is depressed or something. So yeah, it's bad. What I'm looking to Tara for is the relative badness scale.
Sure.
Because I think that's where her knowledge is going to come in.
Yes. Same.
Well, thank you for respecting my, my expertise in this area. This is a very bad episode for sure. But the question is, like, is it no-knack worthy because it's such a turning point for where there were going to be more bad episodes than good ones, which is pretty much from this point forward. And I think that's true of really any sitcom that lasts this long. Like, past a certain point, it's not going to get better. But this one is really notable. And I was so interested when you picked it because I didn't remember it was these three plot lines, which really have nothing to do with each other at all and are each individually so dumb and boring. Like, they just, it really seems like, someone set themselves a challenge of, like, what is the worst material I can give these absolute fucking pros and Jason Alexander to put it over? He's not good. Dave is right. He's bad. Like, he's really bad in this episode. And not only that, but this is him as, like, his most Nathan Lane Monkey-ish. And then it just makes you wish, like, well, Nathan Lane could have made this good. Like, even if you went in that, like, that area of, like, angry shrillness, Nathan Lane would have been better, of course. So to run down each of the plot lines the way you did, Joe, the chair storyline is for sure the least offensive. It's also the dumbest in that, like, there's nothing to it. And the only reason, as we've said, that it goes over at all is because of mostly Matt LeBlanc, but also his Rachel and Joey's chemistry. And just a note on product placement. There, obviously, Lazy Boy is a real brand. There was not a chair called the Ecliner 3000 EW from a story at the time that I looked up says it was, they changed that for legal reasons. So it's not as bad as the also very bad season 6 episode where it's all about Pottery Barn.
Oh, right. The apothecary table.
The apothecary table.
Yeah.
Which is like, that was the nadir for product placement on the show, I think. I can't remember of any that was worse because, like, the show was so big that they probably could get away with not having to do that even when opportunities like that came to them. Like, there's never a storyline where it's like, look at this new car I'm buying for no good reason.
Yeah.
Let's all examine the features. Like, we see you.
Yeah. Whenever a character's not talking, they have to be chewing gum and then, Wrigley.
Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah, that one is like, you're right. It's fine. It's just mostly dumb. The Monica and Ross and Jack one is like, it's mean, but it's not even like the meanest her parents get.
Yeah.
It's just, it's just so half-assed. And like the thing of like Monica losing all her memories is actually really sad. And her getting a Porsche to like compensate her is really not, you know, it doesn't make up for anything. It's dumb. And seems like it was maybe only set up so that they could have future like car related plot lines that were not about the car itself in the future. Like, well,
remember
Ross getting pulled over.
Remember that famous Porsche tax burden episode? That was funny. Before you get off the garage stuff, did they explain the geography of the flood at all? Because I'm trying to fit my brain around how the Porsche versus the boxes, how the boxes lose and the Porsche wins there.
Well, I think we're supposed to think he moved them around it.
Yeah,
he used the sandbags.
Water.
I see. Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
I was thinking on a Z plane, like he's moving things up and down. Got it.
But at the same time, like from a logic perspective, if you have like a dozen boxes that are moldy, why if you're Jack Geller, why do you still have them? Like, why wouldn't you have gotten rid of them?
Yeah, like this is not how homeowners behave.
No,
sorry.
Even if you grant all the other stuff of like how much they've let the house go, which there's a lot of jokes about, like the broken branch and whatever.
The crack in the foundation. Yeah.
Exactly. so whatever to that one. But the suicide one is really the meanest, especially given Phoebe's backstory with her mother, and like they do play it for laughs, but in so much more interesting, effective ways in previous episodes of like where she's just offhand about it. And it, like, this is so it's cruel to both of these performers, but it's also nonsensical in that, like, even in an office where everyone hated you, like, this is not how people behave. Like,
yeah.
Someone's sitting in the middle of all your cubes yelling, I'm going to kill myself, or yelling anything at all. Like, you react like putting all of these NPCs like in the middle of the storyline to just not react and like put it over of like, this is why he's hopeless. It's like,
hang on one second. I just want to acknowledge Tara's video game reference there.
Thank you so much. Okay. I am on the internet.
Yeah.
That's non-playing characters, everybody. They all have to stand around and just not react in order for this to work at all, which it doesn't. And like, this is just not recognizable human behavior. So are there worse episodes of Friends than this? Of course, like the Charlie era, the one where Ross is getting quizzed by Greg Kinnear. Like, there's definitely more egregious plot, stunt casting than this too, Jean-Claude Van Damme. Like, but at the same way, what makes it for me Nonak worthy is how half-assed it is. It's like, it's so lazy. It's putting so much pressure on these performers to put over extremely lazy, bad, uninspired season 7 of a sitcom material.
Yeah.
And so this was beautifully presented, Joe. Excellent choice. For me, this is Nonak for sure.
Thank you. All right, let's vote.
Time for the vote, Sarah D. Bunting.
Tara knows best, so I will vote yay for the Nonak.
I agree. This was bad. Certainly, the suicide plot line was terrible. And with Tara's relative perspective to other episodes, I am also going to say this is Nonak worthy. Tara, just officially.
Speaking as someone who puts on TBS every day from 9:30 until 3 p.m. and watches that entire multi-hour block of Friends reruns, this is a Nonak. Yay for me.
All right. So.
Personne n'aurait pu te dire que la vie serait secrète. Ton genre est naze. Tu n'as pas un sou. Ta vie amoureuse est morte à l'arrivée.
That means Friends, season 7, episode 13, the one where Rosita dies. You are hereby inducted into Z Extra High Grade Nonak.
Je serai là pour toi lorsque la pluie tombe. Je serai là pour toi comme je l'ai toujours été. Je serai là pour toi comme tu es là pour moi aussi.
Oh, aussi. Good.
Oh my God.
Americans love a winner.
Yeah.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for winner and loser of the week. Tara has a winner.
Earlier this summer, we talked about how Lance Bass had been trying to buy the Brady Bunch house, and then HGTV swooped in at the last minute and like hugely outbid him so that they could buy the house themselves as a network and then make a show around it. Well, they have indeed agreed to give Lance Bass a production role on the inevitable show about making it over. So congratulations to him, I guess. I don't know.
And
I'm
us,
sure this is
I
what
guess.
He wanted. He gets a paycheck. Hooray.
And loser of the week?
James Franco, some more. This time, it's because Busy Phillips alleges in her new book that he physically assaulted her on the set of Freaks and Geeks. My surprise level, 0.
Dick. Oh, that was it. Speaking about surprises, do you know what time it is? Game time! this is the fifth game time of the season. Season scores are Tara 3, Sarah 1, Value Guess 0. Today we're playing, and this is for Joe, but this one's been sitting in the bank. Waiting for a Joe appearance. Today we're playing Slumming It for an Emmy from Sean Fluger. From Sean Fluger, the silent P, who earns himself an extra credit, redeemable for an extra hot, great mini topic or Dave Forsening of his choosing. Today's game will test your knowledge of the Venn diagram of Emmy nominees and winners and Oscar nominees and winners.
Ooh.
This is how it's going to work. I am going to read you an Emmy Award category, the TV show involved, and the Emmy year in question. All right? Those are three pieces of information you're going to get. For 3 points, you're going to tell me the actor. We got 4 rounds divided into Emmys won and Oscars lost. I'll explain more as we get into it.
Okay.
So, 3 points. I'm going to let you guess on each level because I'm a generous man today.
Sure.
For 3 points, you name the actor right away after the clues. Guess incorrectly, I'm going to give you the year of the Oscar win or nomination, after which a correct guess is 2 points. If you still need another clue, I will give you the movie title that in question on the Oscar side of
okay.
things. After which the right answer is worth a single point. All right. Okay. So that's a lot of clues. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the whoms and haws. All right.
Yep.
I might be moving things along a little faster this round.
Okay.
All right. Does that make sense? It'll make a little more. It'll flow a little bit better once we get into the
question. Yeah.
Okay. That steel mill situation, please, Tara.
Well, okay. Sarah has 5. Value guests have 1. I have none. Are we doing an equalizer on this game?
No. There's a lot of questions here, so I think we're just going to power through it. All right. So, are we ready to play? Excuse me. Slummy it for an Emmy, guys.
Yes, sir.
Pills.
Are you?
Okay. Here we go. Let's throw it to Picky to see who's going to go first.
We will start with Tara.
All right. Tara, Joe, Sarah, here we go. Tara. Emmy Award category, Outstanding Guest Actor in a Comedy Series. The show is a little show called Friends. Mm-hmm. The Emmy year, 2001. All right, round one is they won the Emmy and they won the Oscar.
Okay.
All right. So who is the Oscar winning nominee we're talking about here on the Emmy? Outstanding guest actor in a comedy series for Friends in 2001.
Okay. Is it Sean Penn?
It is not Sean Penn. All right. The Oscar year, 2018. This person won an Oscar in 2018.
Oh, shit. Who won an Oscar this year that was on Friends?
All right. Your last clue, Tara. The movie The Darkest Hour.
Oh, Gary Oldman.
Gary Oldman, 1 point. That's how we play it.
Joe did Reed. Did you know that immediately offhand?
No, I would have guessed Sean Penn just like you did.
All right.
All right, here's Joe's first one. Outstanding guest actor in a comedy series. Same category.
Okay.
The show, Mad About You, the Emmy years, 97, 98, and 99.
Oh.
3 Emmys.
Is this Mel Brooks?
That is Mel Brooks.
One.
Nicely done. All right, Sarah. Outstanding guest actress in a comedy series. Actress. The show, Ellen. The Emmy year, 98.
Laura Dern.
The Oscar year, 93. This Emmy winner won an Oscar in 93.
I don't remember who won Oscars. This is so Joe.
All right, the movie in question, Howard's End. Can you name the actress from that?
Emma Thompson.
That's good for a point.
She's so funny on that Ellen episode. I also have to say, like, seek out that episode. It's really good.
I just rewatched it for that Sean Penn story that I did for Mel, and yet she's good. Wow, he's so bad.
Outstanding guest actress in a comedy series, Tara. The show, Louie. The year for the Emmy win, 2013.
Ellen Burstyn. Ooh. Shit!
All right. The Oscar year, 2011.
I don't know.
The movie, The Fighter. The Fighter.
The Fighter.
A woman who won for The Fighter? Oh, Melissa Leota.
All right, that's good for 1 point. Back to Joe, who's leading the game so far. Outstanding guest actress in a comedy series for Glee in 2011.
Gwyneth Paltrow?
Correct.
Oh, my God.
Shakespeare
and Love
that's
in
how you do
1999.
It.
All right, to Sarah. Outstanding lead actor in a miniseries or movie for Hatfields and the McCoys in 2012.
Kevin Costner.
Nice.
All right, Tara.
Yeah.
Outstanding lead actor in a miniseries or movie, Behind the Candelabra, 2013.
Oh no, it could be one or the other. I'm gonna
lead
guess.
Actor in a miniseries or movie.
Okay, Michael Douglas.
Michael Douglas, 3 points. Joe.
Yes.
Outstanding lead actor in a miniseries or movie, Tuesdays with Maury in 2000.
Tuesdays with Maury is Jack Lemmon.
McLovin, correct.
Dang.
1956, he won Mr. Roberts.
He did.
Sarah D. Bunting, outstanding lead actor in a miniseries or movie, Angels in America, 2004.
2004.
Lead actor.
Lead actor. now my mind has emptied. Al Pacino.
Wow, nice.
Phew. Tara Ariano, outstanding lead actress in a drama series, Brothers and Sisters, 2007.
Sally Field.
Joe Reed, outstanding lead actress in a limited series or movie, Big Little Lies.
Lead actress. That would be Nicole Kidman.
Outstanding lead actress, Sarah D. Bunting, in a miniseries or movie, Game Change. 2012.
Julianne Moore?
Oh. Nice.
Tara. Outstanding lead actress in a miniseries or movie, actress, Angels in America, 2004.
Meryl Streep.
All right, back to Joe. Outstanding lead actress. Those words no longer have any meaning for me. I've said it so much. In a miniseries or movie, Elizabeth the First.
Helen Mirren.
Right. Outstanding lead actress in a miniseries or movie, Grey Gardens 2009, Sarah.
Oh, God. I don't remember who was in that. Robert Guillaume.
Incorrect. The Oscar gear, 1983.
Sissy Spacek?
The movie Tootsie.
Jessica Lange?
All right. Outstanding, say it with me, outstanding lead actress in a miniseries or movie. Mildred Pierce, 2011.
Kate Winslet.
Wow, is that long ago already? Holy shit.
Yeah.
All right.
We've been living in this country for a long time, Dave.
Outstanding miniseries and directing for a miniseries or a movie. From the Earth to the Moon, 1998.
Tom Hanks?
Yeah, Tom Hanks. Outstanding supporting actor in a miniseries or movie for Sarah. Empire Falls, 2005.
Paul Newman?
Nice.
All right, everybody's last question of round one coming up. Outstanding supporting actress in a drama series for Tara. Downton Abbey 2016.
Oh, no. Who was on that also? Oh, Maggie Smith.
Maggie Smith. Yes. 1979 for anybody?
1979 was California Suite.
The Prime of Miss Jean Brody.
That was a different year, but that was also her second Oscar, yes.
Joe Reed.
Yes.
Outstanding supporting actress in a miniseries or movie, Political Animals 2013.
This is Ellen Burstyn.
It indeed is. 3 points. All right, last question of round one. Outstanding supporting actress in a miniseries or movie. American Horror Story 2014. What supporting actress also won an Oscar?
Is this Jessica Lange? Also?
All right. The Oscar was won in 1991.
I don't know. Hint.
The movie was Misery.
Kathy Bates.
All right, that is round one. Scores,
Vista
please.
Mr. Bates. All right. Sarah has 15 points. I have 17 points. Joe has 21 points, spanking us, but not that badly.
Not bad.
And there's still lots of game, although the rounds are a little shorter from now on. Okay. Round two, exactly the same premise, except these are won the Emmy, lost the Oscars.
Okay.
So they were nominated, but lost. All right.
Here's where Joe will really be a Viking. Uh-huh. Let's go.
Tara Ariano, we're starting with you.
Yep. Okay.
Best performance by an actress in a miniseries or motion picture made for television.
Okay.
The show, Life with Judy Garland, Me and My Shadows, in 2002?
Judy Davis.
Judy Davis for 3 points.
Nice.
She was nominated for Husbands and Wives. Mr. Reed, outstanding guest actor in a comedy series, Will and Grace, 2003.
Oh, God, that really narrows it down, huh?
No kidding.
Will and Grace 2003, so was nominated for an Oscar but didn't win an Oscar.
That's correct.
Is this Matt Damon?
It's not. It's a tricky one. All right. The Oscar year, 1969.
Okay. 1969, Oscar year. Okay. Yeah. All right.
All right. I'm going to give you the movie.
Yes.
The movie is The Producers.
The Producers. Oh, Gene Wilder.
Gene Wilder. Good for 1 point. Sarah D. Bunting. Outstanding guest actress in a comedy series for Shameless in 2015.
I'm never going to know that. Robert Guillaume.
Okay, not an actress, but okay.
I understand that.
1989 was the Oscar year.
What was the Oscar year?
1989. To remind you, it is an actress.
Yes, I get it.
Well, you know, Benson has powers. You can reset your mind once he's invoked.
Also, 1998, if you want an additional hint, she was nominated more than one.
Hey, bonus hint.
That doesn't help. I need the last hint, please.
Working Girl.
Oh, Joan Cusack?
That's good for a point.
Nice.
Take it.
Outstanding lead actor in a comedy series for 30 Rock in 2007.
Alec Baldwin.
Alec Baldwin, nominated for The Cooler. Joe.
Yes.
Outstanding lead actor in a miniseries or movie for The Gathering Storm in 2002.
The Gathering Storm was...
Gathering.
Shit, no, it's one of like three identical British actors who all played Churchill. This one was Brendan Gleeson.
Which? We call that the Dumbledore
effect. No, he's never been nominated for an Oscar. Damn it, I'm not going to get it.
All right, I'm going to buzz you on this one. The Oscar year, 2001.
2001. Was Albert Finney.
That's good for 2 points, though.
Nice. That was
our first 2 points of the game. Yeah.
But you're right. That could have just as easily been Michael Gambon or like any.
Or Tom Wilkinson.
Ryan Cox,
I'm telling you, we've got to call that the Dumbledore.
You're right.
Yes. Yeah.
You're right.
Sarah D. Bunting, outstanding lead actress in a miniseries or movie for John Adams, 2008.
Oh, God.
John Adams.
Lead actress in a miniseries or movie. John Adams. Stop abusing the men in thing, guys.
I know. Can I have the first hint, please?
Also 2008, same year. Won the Emmy, lost the Oscar.
I will need the last hint.
All right. The movie is You Can Count on Me.
That was 2008. That was 2000.
Yeah, 2008 was The Savages. Also,
okay.
Well,
so
let's take Laura a moment Liddy. Here and curse Sean Fluger's name. Curse you, Sean Fluger.
Is it Laura Linney?
She got it right.
All right. So I'm going to give you 2 points because
fair.
Yeah, because of all that. Okay,
2 points counted.
All right.
Last
question of round two, guys. Won the Emmy, lost the Oscar. Outstanding made for television movie. All right. This is, I'm going to guess, actor. I'm not quite sure.
Okay.
We seem to have missing information, but let's just say
fair enough. Okay.
Miss Evers Boys, 1997.
Is this Elfrey Woodard?
Actor.
Oh, actor. Sorry. I don't know. Okay.
1994.
Proceed. Don't know the male lead of that movie, so I'll take the last hint.
What's Love Got to Do with It?
Lawrence Fishburne.
1 point. All right. Joe's last question of round two. Outstanding supporting actress in a limited series or movie, that being Big Little Lies 2017.
This is Laura Dern.
This is Laura Dern. All right. Last question of round two. Outstanding supporting actress in a miniseries or movie George Wallace, 1998.
Hint, please.
1996 was the Oscar nomination.
I need the last hint.
For a movie
I feel
called...
like I knew this. Sorry.
Sorry, what was it?
For a movie called Georgia.
Okay. Oh my God. Which one?
Supporting actress.
Supporting actress.
On
I
the
mean,
TV side. All right,
I know,
the answer
I know,
there
but
is...
I had two choices and I couldn't pick, so that's fine.
Well, do you want to say one now? Last chance.
Sure, Mayor Winningham. Oh.
All right, that's round two.
Okay, Sarah has 18 points. I have 24 points. Joe has 27 points.
All right, close game. Round
points?
Three, guys.
The spankening continues.
Yes, yeah, Sarah, you have 19.
Oh, sorry. Got it.
Round three. They lost the Emmy, but won the Oscar. All right.
Okay.
All right. First one. Outstanding documentary or nonfiction special. All right. So they're involved with that. The title in question is Virunga. Virunga.
Virunga.
2015.
Uh-huh. No idea. Proceed.
All right. The Oscar year was 2016. The victorious Oscar year was 2016.
Yeah.
The movie was The Revenant.
Okay. Leonardo DiCaprio?
Yeah. He probably narrated, I'm guessing.
Okay.
Joe Reed, outstanding lead actor in a drama series for The Westworld 2017. Oscar winner.
Lead actor, so
Emmy
he lost
loser.
The Emmy. Right. Anthony Hopkins.
Anthony Hopkins. Sarah D. Bunting, outstanding lead actor in a limited series or movie, Wizard of Lies, 2017.
Is this
also a
Robert De Niro?
From, Big Mouth, by the way, Wizard of Lies.
Is it Robert De Niro?
It is Robert De Niro, and you got 3 points. Tara Ariano, outstanding lead actor in a miniseries or movie, Behind the Candelabra, 2013. Lost
Didn't
the Emmy.
Have this one?
Yeah.
You lost the Emmy, though, this one.
Lost the Emmy.
Oh!
Okay, Matt Damon?
Tricky.
Outstanding lead actor in a miniseries or movie, Anne Frank, The Whole Story, 2001.
Darn. And I'm not going to get it from this.
All right. Whoops, sorry.
I'll take it.
Okay, Oscar-winning year, 83.
Ben Kingsley.
Correct, for Gandhi.
Wow, nice.
I was thinking Natalie Portman for some reason, so I was like, wow, what a prodigy.
Outstanding lead actor in a miniseries or movie, A Dog Year, 2010.
What? Yeah, I'm not going to get it from that. Hint.
2010, the Oscar year.
I should know that from Oscar's Death Race, but fell out of my head. Last hint, please.
Movie, Crazy Heart.
This is lead actor. Jeff Bridges?
Correct. Outstanding lead actor in a miniseries or special. Sarah, Plain and Tall, 1991.
Oh, no. Who was in this? I'm going to guess James Cromwell.
Oh, if only that were right, man.
I mean, Oscar. Who's more plain and tall than that guy? Am I right? I know he's not Sarah, but still.
All right. The lead actor for Sarah Plain and Tall was nominated for won an Oscar in 1979.
Oh, great. I don't know. John Voight?
For The Deer Hunter.
Christopher Walken.
All right. Good for a point. Joe Reed, outstanding lead actress in a limited series or movie for Big Little Lies, 2017.
So nominated but didn't win. So this would be Reese Witherspoon.
Reese Witherspoon, Walk the Line was her Oscar win. Outstanding lead actress in a limited series or movie, Feud, 2017, Sarah. You have approximately two choices.
Yeah. let's hope I'm right, Susan Sarandon.
Correct. Tara Ariano. That was Dead Man Walking. Yes. Was her Oscar win. Lead, outstanding lead actress in a miniseries or movie for More Tales of the City. How could something called More Whatever actually get a nomination? That doesn't feel right. All right. More Tales of the City, 96.
Olympia Dukakis.
Nice.
Outstanding lead actress in a miniseries or special for Joe, Norma Jean and Marilyn, 96 as well.
Mira Sorvino.
Mira Sorvino. Yeah.
Wow.
Sarah D. Bunting, outstanding supporting actor in a drama series, Ray Donovan. 2014.
This is John Voight.
This is John Voight. Yes. Correct. All right. Everybody's last question of round three. Outstanding supporting actor in a miniseries or movie for Tara, Conspiracy 2007.
Oh, God. Speaking of interchangeable.
Originally known as Room Full of Nazis.
Seriously. I'm going to just take a stab at it and say Stanley Tucci. No, he hasn't won an Oscar. That's a terrible guess.
All right.
The Oscar, should have, though.
The Oscar win was 2011.
I still don't know.
Wait.
All right. I don't know if this is a little bit of a performance art here, but the clue is the King's Speech.
Then Colin Firth.
Yeah. All right. 1 point. I enjoyed that. King's outstanding supporting actress in a miniseries or movie. Supporting actress. Normal Heart, 2014. Joe.
Normal Heart was Julia Roberts.
Correct. All right. Last question of round three. Sarah D. Bunting. Yes. Outstanding supporting actress in a miniseries or a movie. The Mists of Avalon, 2002.
Oh, for God's sake. I don't know. Margulies.
1986. An Oscar was won by this person.
Really?
Yeah.
For what was it won, please?
Prizzi's Honor.
Is that Meryl Streep again?
Yes. Angelica Houston.
Oh, of course.
All right, that's round three of four. Everybody's got a few questions left. Let's get the scores.
Okay, Sarah has 29. I have 20, 33. Joe has 25, 35, 41.
Whoa,
Joe
all
has
right.
a lot. Joe has all.
Still
very good at this game.
Yes.
As predicted. Good job, Joe.
Everybody's got four
Don't
questions
choke.
Left, so there's lots of points to be
psych,
had
psych,
still.
Psych, super psych.
I don't know. I got to explain things. Round four. Guess what? Lost the Emmy. Lost the Oscar.
Oh, okay. Well. Okay. Jeez.
Bunch of losers.
Tara Ariano.
Yeah.
Outstanding supporting actress in a drama series.
Yep.
6 Feet Under, 2002.
Oh, Rachel Griffiths.
Nice. Nice. Who's complaining now? Not Tara.
No one. No.
Joe Reed, outstanding yes. comedy series. Probably should have been actor there. Entourage, 2007.
I think when
Actually,
it's just
don't,
the show, I
think
it's
this
producer.
Is a producer credit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this would be Mark Wahlberg.
Correct. Sorry about that.
All right.
Sarah D. Bunting, outstanding guest actress in a drama series for Smash, 2012.
Oh, God, she did, didn't she?
Guest actress in Smash, 2012. Also nominated for an Oscar. Didn't win that either.
Oh, Cher's out. But I'll just guess Cher anyway, because she's fun.
The Oscar year in question, 1995. It was the mid-90s.
Okay. I don't know. Jessica Lange, that's worked out.
I thought I knew, but I don't.
All right, the movie Pulp Fiction.
Oh, right.
What?
Guest actress in Smash. Didn't win for Pulp Fiction either.
Oh, geez. I really got to do that Smash rewatch. Uma Thurman.
Good for a point.
And I think if we can all agree, if there had been a third season of Smash, Cher would be on it.
Yeah. Cher would be it.
Outstanding guest actress in a drama series, The Closer, 2011.
I don't know who guessed it on that thing. Hint.
1991. Oscar not won.
Okay. Keep going.
Dances with Wolves.
Mary McDonald. Mary McDonald.
Joe Reed, outstanding lead actor in a miniseries or a movie. For the show Wallander in 2009.
Jesus, Wallander. No, I don't know. What year?
1993.
So 93, you're either doing.
Here we go.
Yeah.
93, you're either doing Hackman or Pacino. So I'm going to guess Hackman, Gene Hackman.
All right. This All lead right. actor didn't win in 93 for a movie called Henry V.
Oh, he won a writing award. Kenneth Branagh.
Correct. For 1 point. I mean, who else is it going to be if it's Wallander?
Yeah. Really? I guess.
Yeah.
Sarah D. Bunting, outstanding lead actor in a miniseries or movie for King Lear, 2009.
Hint.
2002 was the unsuccessful Oscar year for this actor.
Does not help. Hint.
Lord of the Rings, : Fellowship of the Ring, : that way.
Also doesn't help, so let's just guess Tom Wilkinson.
Anybody steal Milton? No, that's Ian McKellen.
Oh, him. Yeah.
He played
Dumbledore.
David Copperfield.
What a dick would I be if I did a steal meal and ruined it for the next person who is valued guest?
Joe wins, nobody else gets a chance.
All for
Salt
silence.
The field,
All
says
for
Joe Reed. All right. Tari Ariano.
Yes.
Outstanding lead actress in a drama series.
Yep.
Each one now, every time I say outstanding, I'm going to try to sell it more.
The wicked
lead sound. Actress in a drama series for The Sopranos in 1999. Didn't win that.
Oh, God. Edie Falco? Yeah, I didn't think she was ever nominated for an Oscar.
Oscar year. Unsuccessful Oscar year for this actress, 1991.
Hmm. Okay, keep going.
That ring any bells?
No.
You sure? Because that's Goodfellas.
Oh, the rainbow.
All right, do it. Let's do it. Ding dong.
What?
Rings any bells? Come on, we're ringing the bell.
Oh,
come on.
Right.
No, I want to hear it.
You have a whore living in Tua. Come on.
Janice Rossi.
I was like, Nancy Marchand? I
do
seriously completely
hear me?
Forgot about Lorraine Bracco.
We're not continuing until you do it, Tara.
Get your own goddamn man. Come on, just do it.
Get your own goddamn man!
There it is.
All right. Jersey. Joe Reed, outstanding lead actress in a miniseries or a movie, Georgia O'Keeffe, 2010.
Oh, was this Joan Allen?
This was Joan Allen.
All right.
For the contender.
This is Joe Reed, folks. Dang.
Sarah D. Bunting, outstanding lead actress in a miniseries or movie, Mrs. Harris, 2006.
Four-time Oscar loser, this one.
That
she's the Buffalo Bills of losing Oscars.
She is the Buffalo Bills of Oscars.
Wide right. Hint, please.
2011, the Oscar was not won.
Oscar was not won. By, I don't know, Michelle Williams.
For The Kids Are All Right.
Oh, yeah, her. Annette Bening.
Yep, good for 1 point. All right, everybody's last question coming up. I think Joe has it, but let's just get the scores just so we know.
For sure he does. Sarah has 25-31. I have 25-38. Joe has 50.
The rest.
No, Joe has 48.
All right, this last question is worth 100 points. No. Tara Ariano, outstanding! Lead actress in a miniseries or a movie, Burton and Taylor, 2014.
Helena Bonham Carter.
Yeah.
Wow. Nice.
Do you have any guesses what she was nominated for on the Oscar side?
Totally would have guessed Lohan.
She was nominated twice for Oscars.
Do you know them? Do you know what this one is in 98?
And The Wings of the Dove.
Yeah. Yep. Very nice. Joe Reed, your last question. Outstanding. Lead actress in a miniseries or a movie for Political Animals 2013. This lead
nominated
actress.
For an Oscar, but not win from political. Oh, Sigourney Weaver.
Sigourney Weaver, 89 for.
That would be Working Girl.
Working Girl, correct. Yeah. Sarah D. Bunding, our last question of the game. Outstanding.
Outstanding.
Supporting actor in a miniseries or a movie for Game Change 2012. Supporting actor. Didn't win for Game Change.
Oh. And
didn't win for the Oscar in 96.
Oh, that's not who I thought it was going to be. Hint.
For The Truman Show. Didn't win for Game Change. Didn't win for Truman Show.
Didn't win for Truman Show. Ed Harris.
Stop it. Yeah.
All right, that is the game. Scores, please, Dar.
Okay, Sarah has 32. I have 41. Joe has 51. His performance is outstanding.
I will stop doing that now, maybe.
All right, guys. I have two tiebreakers, which will now be converted into steal meal opportunities.
Okay.
The first one is won the Emmy, lost the Oscar. All right. After I read all three of the items, first person to answer wins. If nobody's speaking up, I'll start giving other clues.
Okay.
Won the Emmy, lost the Oscar. Outstanding lead actor in a miniseries or movie. The show George Wallace, the Emmy year 98.
Gary Sinise.
Yes. Nice. 95 Forrest Gump. All right. Second one. Just in case, we had a three-way tie. This is how I build them. Lost the Emmy, lost the Oscar. Outstanding lead actor for a miniseries or a movie. For the for Love or Country, the Arturo Sandoval story, 2001.
Oh, God.
The Oscar year, 91. The movie... Hold on to your butts. Godfather 3.
Andy Garcia.
Oh, Joe predictably picks
Andy
up both.
Andy Garcia.
See, you could have spent one carelessly, Joe, and still would have been ahead.
I'm leaving my fellow valued guests with a bounty of steel.
What a mensch.
Joe, congratulations. Well done.
Joe!
All right, guys. Joe. That is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We opened wide for season two of Big Mouth before going around the dial with stops at America to Me, Maniac, Chuck, and Dreamland. Joe successfully pitched the Friends episode, the one where Rosita dies, for the Nonak. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Joe was the winner of this week's award show Game Time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
Cubes,
Sarah D. Bunting.
That was beautiful. No
and
notes.
Joe Reed.
My pubes.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next time in 2 weeks, right here on Extra Hot Great.
Fuck all these fucking fucks!
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.